What's up, everybody? Happy New Year. Anthony Frieda here. Welcome back to Badum Biz. All right, today on the show, we have a fantastic guest. His name is Pat Van Dyke. Pat is an amazing drummer, multi-instrumentalist, producer, composer. And you'll hear me on the episode. I was stunned listening to his material, to his music. Incredible music. The guy has an impressive career too. It was awesome to talk to him. I would say if you have career aspirations in music, listen to this episode. This is fantastic. He gave some great details. We had a great conversation. Incredibly nice guy. Do yourself a favor. Go find his music. Go on his Spotify. His Bandcamp. Go check him out on Instagram. All right, good way to start off 2021. So please enjoy the episode. Pat Van Dyke, welcome, man.
What's up, everybody? Happy to be here with Anthony.
So, Pat, I was just listening to a bunch of your material. You have quite a list of just tons of material on your Bandcamp. And, I want to dive right in because you're mainly, you're a composer, right? You would say that you're a composer, but your background, is it on drums first? Because you're a multi-instrumentalist too.
For sure. So, yeah. I went to college as a jazz performance major on the drums. I actually played piano first when I was much, much younger. But the focus definitely shifted from piano to drums, you know, in grade school and through high school and college. However, I always wrote and recorded music. So I was always picking up a guitar, bass, playing keys, even when my real focus in study was on the drum set and percussion. I still, back in the day, on cassette four tracks as a, you know, fourth and fifth, sixth grader, in punk rock bands and rock and roll bands in seventh and eighth grade. And then, you know, even with little like jazz trios and things like that with buddies of mine that I was growing up kind of learning how to play. We were always recording music. I was always interested in writing music. Once I got into college, I got really into hip hop production and mixing and all that kind of all stuff has kind of become part of the arsenal. I would say definitely in recent years, I've spent much more time producing, writing, composing than I do behind a drum set. However, still in like live situations, if, you know, my band were to perform and we were to play a gig, I would be playing the drums, you know, most likely. So
very cool. Very cool to hear. Yeah. Let's go into a little detail about what I heard. First of all, the mix is incredible. Truly was blown away. I wanted to ask you about that because I do home recording. You know what I mean? I'm nowhere close to a mix engineer. However, I do like to pursue always, you know, how do I get a better mix? You'll hear a reference on a song. Man, how did they get this to sound so warm but airy and not, you know? So your sound on a bunch of these songs is so warm, and the drums, of course, sound fantastic. You're using Rhodes. I hear a lot of that. I hear saxophone. I hear guitar, bass. Everything is so clear in its own mix. Are you also a mix engineer?
I do mix my own records. So most of the stuff, I would think, with the last time I didn't mix a record was this hip hop project called Lux DeVille that came out in like, I want to say 2013. That was the only record. That was the last record that I did not mix. So everything since then, all my solo stuff, all collaborations that I've done, singles, any of the breakbeat series, that's all stuff that I've mixed. And recorded either in a studio that I had in Jersey City for 12 years, something like that. When I say studio, it was really like a rehearsal space kind of converted to a studio with a small booth and, you know, kinks of figuring out how to do it, how to get the sounds I wanted. Obviously, it was a little bit of trial and error. I didn't go to school for, you know, sound engineering arts or mixing or anything like that, but I've always been kind of a student of that and appreciated the role of a producer, the role of a you know, mix engineer, and tried to dig deep into, you know, how those individuals attain their sound, right? Like if I'm listening to a Danger Mouse record, you know, he might have produced the record with Norah Jones, he produced the record with the Black Keys, and kind of finding the common ground amongst you know, amongst those releases. So yeah, I'm always a student of production, of mixing, and yeah, all the stuff I've released under my own name or as collaborations have been things that I've mixed primarily in Ableton Live. Before that, it was Digital Performer, which is a kind of, I don't know if it's even still around, but another DAW of the early days. And more recently, I've been doing some recording and mixing on a Tascam 388, which is a 8-track quarter-inch tape machine that my buddy Zach kind of gave me about 2 years ago. So more recent stuff I've been recording on there, which can definitely be responsible for some of those warmer analog sounds you'll hear. Oftentimes, I like record the rhythm tracks, bass, drums, keys, guitar there, and then or on the tape machine, and then dump it into the computer for, you know, being able to automate things and really, the efficiency for me is a little better on the computer. But you can really, it's like this instant vibe when you record onto this tape machine. It's got a really great sound. So
super cool to hear, because one of the things I listening to your, like one of the volumes of your breaks, which is about, you do about like a little over 20 different sort of break beats on one volume of like a CD release, but you have about 6 of those, right? Something like that, right? So I was listening through that, and I was listening through the one that was, what was it called? It was called Hello Summer. Mm-hmm. And also the Let's Get Lost. I was listening to that too. So one of the things that I noticed was you're getting all totally different drum sounds, and they, I would say, range from all the way to like classic, maybe like 60s type sounds, right? To where I'm asking myself, is that a sample? Because that sounds like a hip hop sample, the way you mixed it, the way you compressed it and all that stuff. To me, that lights me up, gets me really excited. So it was most of that stuff just recorded, you know, with a microphone on some drums and then mixed?
Yeah. I want to say, I mean, all of it, of the things you just mentioned, yeah, all of it. So the PVD Break series basically started as like me trying to learn how to mix drums. And I mentioned, you know, I was always into producing on an MPC 2000, on a Korg Triton, on a TS-10, you know, more from like a beat maker standpoint, and sampling drums and things like that. So, and all the references you mentioned, like 60s Stax Records, Al Jackson, stuff like that, those are all the drum sounds that I really wanted to be able to recreate. And I've always kind of worked on a relatively, not about a budget, but like, like minimal budget, but it's not that. It's just more that I'll work with what I have. If I have an SM57 and a D6 kick drum mic and a, you know, relatively inexpensive condenser that I can use as an overhead, I'll start there and kind of figure out how I can attain the mix that I want using what I have, as opposed to just like, oh, I need this plugin or oh, I need this mic to make it happen. So, but that definitely, what you said about it sounding like, oh, is this a sample or is this a, you know, a break that was taken from another record, is definitely a conscious thing that I'm trying to attain with the way I'm mixing it and the way I'm recording it, or maybe the mic placement or things of that nature. But I mean, you can see behind me this drum set. It's like the last 2 or 3 breakbeat series I recorded in my basement with, you know, very minimal mics, and it was all in one room, Some of the older stuff was in different studios, different drum kits, things like that. Occasionally there'll be different drum kits, but you know, it's all really DIY in the sense that I'm doing it here, I'm doing it with what I have, and then kind of using my creativity in the mix process to create to create these like different textures and different sounds, basically all starting from the same place. So that is the challenge of creating those breakbeat series, because you know, you got a few different microphones, a few different kick drums, a few different snare drums, things like that, and then to try to create all these different textures and one sound this way, one sound that way, and kind of run the spectrum of recorded, you know, the library of recorded, you know, drum sounds that are out there that exist, you know, trying to capture this type of thing and trying to capture this type of thing. The one I did on the 388 entirely, and did that with a little Benson, not plate reverb, spring reverb. That one was entirely outside of the computer, which was quite a challenge too. But yeah, I mean, all those releases, the solo releases, the breakbeat releases, it's all process with the mix, trying to get the sounds I want. And, you know, starting from, you know, dialing up a bass sound that I want, not just saying, oh, I'm going to plug it in direct and then kind of massage it in the with a whole bunch of plugins. Really try to attain the sound you want first, whether that be like, you know, the way you're tuning the drums, the way you're muffling the drums, what sticks you're playing with, whatever, those type of things. But, yeah, real deliberate and intentional.
It's so cool. Listening to some, you know, a couple of the tracks, one thing that was really cool was you have some songs you have a mix of like this. Tell me if this makes sense to you. But in certain electronic music influences or sounds, there's this quality to it that is inhuman, sort of. It's almost like looking at something very abstract, not of this world. That's what it sounds like. And you have also sounds that sound very human. So you'll have like a horn section, for instance, playing. And sometimes your drums sound more organic acoustic drums. Sometimes they sound more hip hop electronic sampled, right? And the mix of those, all of those types of those elements, it kind of, it's weird. It weirdly grounds you sometimes with those human sounds while also taking you on a trip somewhere in the universe with those extraterrestrial sounds, sort of. I like that a lot. It kind of reminds me of like that, if you know this word, umami. It's like the flavor spectrum when eating food. It kind of, there's so many things to taste basically when I'm listening. So super cool, man.
Yeah, so I mean, a lot of that, like, I'm sure you're familiar with the Sly Stone record called "There's a Riot Going On," where it's like a lot of, you know, a lot of kind of primitive drum machines layered underneath the live drums. So you know, that's kind of like something that's definitely a big inspiration for, you know, for that process for me. It's like I'll oftentimes, the drums might be the last thing I'm recording. I might be tracking everything to a, you know, I have this old vintage drum machine called an Ace Tone, Rhythm Ace, and it's like it's the company that eventually became Roland. I also have this old Hammond Cadet organ, which has a small, like, little drum machine. It was meant for, like, you know, people to play solo on, but it's got this, you know, really rinky-dink, old vintage sounding drum machine, where I might track everything to that and then layer the live drums on top at the end. Maybe eventually get rid of the program drums or the, you know, the drum machine loops. But yeah, kind of combining those or straddling the fence of, like, you know, electronic stuff or sampled stuff or hip-hop stuff versus more acoustic or organic approach to, you know, like the playing. And I think a lot of that also comes from the fact that like the last two or three records have not been like band performances, whereas the first, you know, my first two solo records, Technicolor Hi-Fi and Right on Time, I tracked things in my studio. I was playing drums, there was a bass player, and there was a keyboard player. And then I'd kind of take it from there and then really produce it and do a bunch of overdubs, and I'd play guitar and, you know, add synth parts and percussion parts. But the fact that since those two records, everything's basically been me, with the exception of like there might be a soloist here or there, or I'll write horn parts and have a horn player or a horn section come in. But yeah, it makes it so I'm really conscious of like every decision in the process, right? As opposed to just being like, all right, cool, the band played, we got the rhythm tracks, now let's move from there. It's like if you're looking at everything under a, you know, with a microscope because you're playing every single part, things tend to take a little longer. So it might not be the most efficient process, but it becomes a real deliberate process where you're kind of putting everything under a microscope and making sure it's exactly what you want, and, you know, that you nailed this part. And obviously, with the technology at hand, there's endless amount of editing you can do. Although I try to, you know, that's a fine line. I try to keep it relatively human as well. So, but yeah, long answer. the long version of the answer is, yeah, it's like trying to kind of straddle these two worlds of a CTI like records, you know, Bob James or Eric Gale release with a 90s like ear production, those kind of two worlds and two influences I've always had.
Well, I think it sounds like you were successful. Really cool, man, to listen to. I was going to ask you, so, you know, you're clearly knowledgeable in, when I'm listening to your chord progressions and then I'm reading that, oh, you played bass on this too. You know, you also played a little, you know, organ or whatever, keyboard. And I guess, did those piano lessons you took as a kid, did that sort of inform all of that knowledge of chord progressions, theory, all that stuff? Did that sort of make that all language to you?
Absolutely. I mean, so, yes, having the foundation of, you know, not starting on the drums, starting on an instrument where, you know, there's pitches and, you know, harmony, not that there are pitches and harmony on the drum set as well, but, you know, more defined pitches and, you know, being able to play chord changes and things like that on the piano definitely helped. The fact that I was always writing music, like even when I was playing in these punk rock bands in 7th, 8th, and 9th grade, it was like I was playing the drums and during the shows, but I was picking up a guitar and writing riffs or writing lyrics or having ideas for the arrangement. And then once I got to college, again, I was a jazz performance major on drums, but you had to take like functional piano 1 and 2 and then jazz piano, I think 1 and 2, maybe even 3 and 4. I can't recall, but, you know, learning jazz voicings that work well on the piano, and kind of every time I'd get a little bit of information, I'd take it and try to run with it and do as much as I could. So I'd learn something in this functional jazz piano class and then go back to my dorm room and make a beat with these chord changes, right? Or I'd learn a Stevie Wonder song and then, you know, kind of incorporate those type of things. But really a lot of it has been like, you know, trial and error and just figuring out what works and what doesn't work. And, you know, pushing yourself to get outside of your comfort zone. Because I find myself like, okay, I wrote this song, and then I realized it's like, oh, I think I might have already wrote this song already, right? It's like, because my harmonic knowledge was relatively limited at first, it made it so I was constantly going in the same places, you know, using the same type of resolutions, using the same type of forms. So, you know, saying, all right, I'm going to learn this song today. I'm going to learn a different jazz tune. I'm going to learn a different R&B song. I'm going to learn this, and I'm going to kind of then transpose it, figure out what's happening harmonically. But yeah, all of it's just kind of been a work in progress as it goes, as I do it. And, you know, just embracing the process, you know, trying to get better at, keys. In recent 5 or 6 years, I've definitely made an effort to try to get better at the guitar and the bass, and you know, with those improvements, I was able to not hire a bass player anymore, you know, and play bass on my own records and things like that. And then, you know, guitar and you know, and the list goes on. I haven't yet quite picked up you know, string instruments or horns or brass, but I got enough friends that I can call and tell them what I want and throw them a few bucks and they help me out. So that's always good.
What's something early on, because you said, mentioned something about playing in punk rock bands. You know, I could say the same thing. I was in a punk rock band when I was like in eighth grade, of course. But, you know, what is, what would be music that you were listening to at that age or younger that truly lit a fire of creativity for you?
I mean, I've always listened to a lot of different things, and that's still the case. So I want to say, like, the most memorable experience was like when I was able to dig through my grandmother's closet where my uncle had lived as a kid, and there was a whole bunch of Kiss records, a whole bunch of Pink Floyd records, a whole bunch of Led Zeppelin records, Grateful Dead, Alice Cooper, stuff like that, like, you know, late 60s, early 70s rock and roll. I became obsessed with John Bonham, became obsessed with Led Zeppelin. That lasted a long time, but I mean, I they're still one of the greatest bands in my opinion, and I still love listening to that stuff. After that, you know, I became kind of infatuated with bands of the time were like NOFX, Lagwagon. Fat Records was the name of the label. They still exist. Like, you know, these guys are probably in their 50s and they're still playing the same, you know, same songs and still releasing music. And I think it's great. But that stuff, I started playing in bands. I grew up in New Jersey. There was a thriving, DIY punk rock scene where guys would rent the American Legion Hall and charge $5 to get in and pay the bands a little something, and we'd come and sell our merch and sell t-shirts. And, you know, I did a lot of that from the time I was like ninth grade through probably sophomore or junior. Some of those bands have gone on to do really, or members of those bands have gone on to do really, successful things in that world. I kind of switched directions, became more interested in bettering my craft on the drums by learning, by studying jazz. And then, so, you know, all that stuff, Philly Joe Jones, Tony Williams, Art Blakey, all the Elvin Jones, all the legendary great drummers of that genre. Again, then went to William Patterson as a jazz studies major, really, really dove into all that stuff, all the jazz greats. But then kind of simultaneously, I'd always loved hip hop. I'd always kind of grown up on the first CD I owned was like, you know, I think I bought Enter the 36 Chambers and The Score by the Fugees and Wu-Tang Clan. Like, that was like the first time, you know, that was probably that was 94. So probably seventh or eighth grade for me. So it was kind of like these, you know, two worlds at this, kind of developing at the same time where I'm listening to, you know, jazz stuff, really studying the art form, and then also currently listening to new music that's coming out in the hip-hop world. Then college, like I said, I was spending hours in a practice room working on, you know, working at a syncopation and then going home or going to the dorm room. And then, so it's always kind of been these, like, you know, pursuing both at the same time. And it wasn't really until recently, I think, where I kind of figured out how I could blend these things and kind of come up with a style that I would call my own. It's not entirely original, but take the influences that have, you know, been a part of my progression and put them all together and, you know, figure out a way to present a, you know, a body of work to the listener. So,
wow. So, when you dove in, I mean, going from like playing in rock bands, punk rock bands to the jazz world, was there like a bridge or a conduit into that world of an artist? Was it like, you know, for me, probably like Miles Davis was listening to Kind of Blue drew me in. Was there something like that for you?
Absolutely. So definitely Miles, like, you know, all the bands, like the first quintet, the second quintet, the later fusion stuff, Bitches Brew in a Silent Way, all that stuff. A good friend of mine who we kind of grew up learning and playing together, eventually going to school together. He's played on a bunch of my records. His name is Rich Polacek. He's a trumpet player.
I know Rich, actually. I've played.
You do? Cool.
A few times.
Yeah, yeah. Rich is the man. So, you know, his dad was into the older, you know, releases. He knew all that stuff because his dad was constantly playing it. So he would hit me to stuff. I was kind of simultaneously listening to, like, you know, newer, like, groove stuff, like some of the Scofield records back then with Dennis Chambers on drums, listening to, like, Modesky, Martin, and Wood, where it was, like, kind of jam band stuff, kind of almost hip-hop oriented, but still, you know, like the instrumentation of a jazz trio or a, you know, organ trio. Yeah, I mean, all those things kind of intertwined, so... I mean, I remember really, really falling in love with the way Tony Williams played, which I think was like a natural thing for a drummer, because it was like, you know, this kind of really active and energetic, you know, way of playing that wasn't necessarily something I'd ever heard before. Listening to Miles Smiles, like where he's playing on Footprints, and just, you know, I didn't realize that the original, the Wayne Shorter version, maybe Billy Higgins. I can't remember who's on that record, but, you know, finding out that was the Miles Smiles version wasn't the original was, like, you know, crazy to me. It was mind blowing. And then coming back to a lot of that stuff, you know, I think I dove into the second quintet, the 60s quintet with Wayne Shorter and Ron Carter and Herbie first, and then kind of went back and checked out the Philly Joe, you know, those releases and those records. But, you know, it all kind of all had the same effect and influence on me in college. It was like, that's all it was, that and then current hip hop of the time. It was like, I wasn't listening to rock music then. Now I do. Now I listen to pop music. I listen to rock and roll music. But yeah, I mean, I would say early on Led Zeppelin, and then, like you said, the Miles stuff, Coltrane stuff, where it kind of just, you buy one record and it's like, oh, who's this drummer? Oh, this drummer played on this record. And it's this lineage that then you can dive into. And, you know, you asked about a conduit. It's like buying those records and reading the liner notes and reading the personnel and those things would just kind of, all right, then I'd go to Tower Records and I'd spend another $100 on, you know, something because it had said it had Billy Higgins on it, or because it said it had Art Blakey on it, you know?
Wow. Yeah, a lot of stuff to dive into in there. I mean, you mentioned, by the way, you mentioned like the Miles stuff from like the late 60s. There are these live recordings that I have where they're playing So What at like a bebop tempo. I mean, and I don't know who's playing drums on it. It sounds like Tony, but it's incredible. It's truly incredible. Doing it in like a theater too, it sounds like.
Yeah, are you talking about the Four and More record with... It is Tony, and it's basically that quintet, but it's George Coleman on sax instead of Wayne. There's that. I mean, there's probably a ton of bootlegs too, but yeah, that record, I think it's called Four and More. It's got a blue cover. I haven't listened to it in years, but yeah, I mean, they're flying through So What, and you know, tempo's through the roof. So
yeah, it's great. And obviously Tony's sound is so identifiable. Everybody's trying to get that ride cymbal sound. Everybody's trying to get that, you know. Whew,
yep.
A lot of stuff to study there. I guess I wanted to ask you about your live performance. Everything I know about you so far is recorded, right? But as far as live performance goes, did you take any of the stuff that you like to record and, you know, that creative stuff to the stage? ever.
Definitely try to. It can be an uphill battle in New York and New Jersey. Getting all the things that are on the recording pulled off live, because, you know, it costs money to hire two keyboard players. It costs money to, you know, to rehearse with guys what you want. And I'm not going to lie, it's definitely been a factor in why I've done less shows in recent years. I used to be gung-ho about, you know, playing every weekend, and the more particular I became about recorded music, and more intentional I became about the way I wanted to release recorded music, the more I realized how hard it was to pull that off live without a boatload of rehearsals, without money to pay guys, without, you know, guys that are dedicated and know the catalog. And while I've had a bunch of guys that have been very dedicated for a long time, some of those guys are now, you know, Josh David Barrett was my guy. He was a bass player for me for, like, I don't know, 5-6 years. Now he's the front man for the Wailers. He's not going to, you know, he's out on the road. Jordan Scanella, bass player, another one who's on the first two records. Great friend, great musician. He's on the road doing Hamilton. It's like, you know, I've had keyboard players that have been with me for 4 or 5 years. One of them recently moved to Colorado. So it becomes harder and harder to keep that up if, you know, people get older. A lot of us have families now. So I definitely do try to do that. Like, if I put a record out, I try to do, like, a big release party and rehearse and get a full band and, you know, the three horns and the whole thing, percussionist, maybe two keyboard players. But, yeah, it can be difficult. So oftentimes it's like we'll be doing something live and it'll be like maybe a, you know, trio or quartet interpretation of what the recorded music is like. And obviously there's an excitement that comes with live music and a spontaneity that comes with live music, and the solos are longer and, you know, there's more dynamics and things like that. So I like to think that they're compositions, but not necessarily an exact, you know, it's not like if you went and saw a pop act and you expected it to sound exactly the same. I have attempted to do that and done it successfully a few times, but like I said, it's a lot of moving parts to make it happen. And now with no gigs, it's like, you know, it's even harder.
That's a whole other subject right there. How you doing through this time? I mean, obviously, a guy who's doing recorded stuff from your own studio, it's not like you're bound, right? But certainly, those performance opportunities are not really on the table for many of us. So, but
absolutely. A few years ago, I definitely made a conscious decision to try. Well, I've always been trying to get my foot in the door with licensing and syncing music for film and writing for ads and things like that, and writing for production libraries. I want to say, you know, there was a good bunch of years where I was trying and, you know, wasn't necessarily reaping any of the benefits. In the past 2 or 3 years, I've definitely seen a lot more success with that, where I have relationships with music libraries that I'll write for. And, you know, stuff gets used in ads, stuff gets used in film. And, you know, it's the type of work where I don't have to do it on a Friday night at, you know, till 1 o'clock in the morning in New York City. I can do it whenever I want in a pair of sweatpants in my basement in front of the computer. So I've been all right for sure. Like, you know, I still play gigs. I still play weddings. I still do those things that have been affected by the pandemic. And, you know, it's definitely taken a hit to my revenue stream, but I'm super thankful that I still have, or that I, you know, that I kind of made the conscious decision when I did a few years ago to really kind of dive headfirst into more production and recording and things like that, which, you know, there's still a market for that stuff right now, if not more than before. You know, people are home, people are watching TV, brands are advertising, they're doing things like that. And I always felt like if it was within my wheelhouse and a skill set that I have and just good practice, you know, good practice for me to, like, all right, I got to create this track. The client sends you a reference and they want you to try to get something that references this, you know, old soul recording or this, you know, this trap thing or this EDM thing. I might not necessarily put my name on it and release it to the world, but if I can make a few bucks doing it and better my skill set in the process, it seems like a win-win.
That's really smart, because I was actually just looking at your website, and I could see it. So you basically wrote music, composed music for TV networks like Vice and HBO and, you know, Fox. And there's also something at the end of that paragraph where it says, did you write music specifically for comedians in cars getting coffee?
No. So two sides to the licensing world. Like, I obviously have a commercial, I have commercial releases with my name on them. Things you'll find on Spotify, Apple Music, things you can, you know, records you can buy. And that stuff, due to the fact that it's instrumental, oftentimes, is very licensable. It's very, there's a need for those type of things. And so, like, the comedians in cars, that stuff was recordings that I put out originally, and they used them, and I got paid for them. So it's more or less like repurposing things that I've already had out existing in the world, right, that people can listen to. Now, a lot of those things, I mean, that bio is pretty old, but a lot of those networks that use that stuff, it is recordings of mine that came out on commercial releases.
Wow.
That being said, I also do write a ton of, production music, what they call production music or library music, for different agencies that have it in their catalog and are able to shop it to their clients. I also work directly with clients occasionally where someone calls me and says, hey, I need this type of thing. So the answer is kind of like yes and no. There's times where they just use existing music of mine and say, hey, we want to license this. What's it going to cost? This is what the use is. You know, this is the term. And then there's also other times where they say, hey, we want you to write this thing. You know, we're pitching this Walmart ad. Can you come up with this? You know, they give me a brief, they give me the video, and they say, you know, we need it yesterday, or they, you know, we need it tomorrow. It's usually very little time. But yeah, both of those things definitely are regular occurrences, which is great. I'm happy that. I mean, ultimately, I would love to just be. The reality is, you know, it's I'm not paying my mortgage off of Spotify streams, so. When those releases get repurposed, I'm always happy. When they get used and, you know, potentially put in front of a bigger audience, I might see a bump on the back end of the actual Spotify stream to the LP sales or things like that. So.
That's cool. So what you were talking about before, you get hired basically to reverse engineer, I guess that's a good word, reverse engineer a sound. I guess they send you a reference track, you said, right? Yeah. And can you make something like this? So is that sometimes, could that be a cool, fun challenge? Does that ever get like, man, this is, I don't want to do this right now. You know, is it ever kind of like, man, this is a challenging one, or I'm not even inspired to do this. Do you ever have any of those?
Absolutely. Luckily, most of the people I work with kind of know. They'll hit me up for things that they think I'm going to be good at, right? So they're not going to hit me up. Like, a lot of these agencies or these music libraries have guys like me. They have composers. They have people that can write and produce and record on their own and stick to a deadline. But they got their EDM guy, they got their hip hop guy, they got their, you know, they got their different guys, and they'll usually hit me up about the things that they know are something that I'm going to hopefully knock out of the park. Regardless, I still try to, if there was something that was going to be a laborious task that I was not interested in doing, I would have no qualms about saying, nah, sorry, I don't have the time. I got other things on a deadline. You know, thanks for the offer. But I mean, that being said, if I'm going to spend time on something, I'm still going to try to make it cool either way. It's like, if I'm going to work on something and give it to a company to pitch to somebody, then I've got to, and it doesn't get chosen, right? I don't get the placement, then I still have it. And I might do something with it. Maybe I'll, you know, send it to a singer or an MC and we'll release it as a song or a single. Maybe I'll use it for a different ad that comes up later on. So, you know, if I'm always trying to make it unique and creative and something cool about it, I'm not just going to do something where it's like, oh, this is really lame and I'm going to create this really lame track because that's the reference they sent me. If that was the gig, I'd have, you know, politely decline.
Well, that's cool. So you're always filling your own library, basically. I like that. So that's cool to hear that. I never heard that perspective of it, which is, okay, well, I'm going to make myself like this. This would be my version of whatever they want. And if they like it, great. If they don't, whatever. But it's now in my library and maybe I can use it. I like that. That's super cool. For your PD breaks, by the way, I wanted to ask you this because, again, it's like every volume you have is like 20 plus, you know, of these really cool sounding, specific sounding beats, right? Mixed in a certain way. Do you get a lot of artists going, hey, you know, have you ever heard your beat on artists' songs or something?
Plenty of times. Yeah. That has been a huge, like, it's built bridges for me, right? It's got, doing those releases has definitely helped out in terms of making relationships with artists. Yes, I hear stuff that I don't know it's going to be, you know, that I didn't know it was there. I also get people that hit me up and say, hey, I use this, check it out. Or, yeah, it's been Marco Polo, this great hip hop producer, did a record with Masta Ace last year. It might have been even 2 years ago at this point. But, you know, he came across the Breakbeat series. He used it. He hit me up on social media. I gave him my blessing for it. And now it's like every time I put something out, I'll send it his way. You know, I'd like to think that if I asked him for a favor or something here or there, or if I wanted an introduction with somebody, you know, those type of things, those type of relationships have flourished from what's come of that Breakbeat series. Sam Barsh, a great writer, piano player, he hit me up 2 days ago. You know, he's like, oh, I'm doing this remix. You know, he's done records for Anderson .Paak. He's done records for Kendrick Lamar. He's done, you know, a bunch of jazz records. So, you know, getting these tools in the hands of producers who are really making moves is always a goal, right? Again, I said I started out doing this thing and hone my craft, like getting better at doing it. And then once I have it, it's a good business card. Here, check this out. Oh, you know, so-and-so hits me. This producer, Tall Black Guy, another really well-known in his world, kind of electronic hip-hop stuff. He's out of Detroit. He uses them all the time. Soof Daddy, this producer from Berlin, uses them all the time. And, you know, sometimes I don't know. Sometimes I was checking out Soup's last record, and I was like, oh, I recognize that. And, you know, I hit him up, and, you know, there was no denying it was something that I had recorded. And, you know, it's always good. It builds bridges, helps me kind of connect with other artists and things of that nature.
I love that. I think that's fantastic. It's like you're creating like a little creative spark in somebody else. You know what I mean? That's really cool. And they're just, you know, you're inspiring them based on what you created. I wanted to pay a compliment too. I didn't talk about your percussion that you put on these songs or these tracks. Sounds fantastic. Also, I'm a percussionist background, like classical, whatever, but drum set's my main thing. So I'm always thinking about, I always love that blend of that perfect blend of those complementary patterns. Sort of even, you can even call it like rhythmic melodies if you want, between the percussion and the drum kit and how it affects the groove. I'm telling you, man, like blown away by how you mixed it even too, because they both blend together so well. So I had to give you hats off to that, man. Really cool.
Appreciate that, man. Yeah.
Did you play the percussion? Did you do all of that stuff yourself too?
Yep.
Wow.
Yep. I'm about to do about to do some overdubs when we get done here. Got a
brown right there. Very cool. Very cool.
They're actually my sons.
Oh, nice. But, nice. Yeah. So, all right. I mean, I don't want to keep you too long because I know you got a busy day. I appreciate you doing this so much, actually.
I appreciate you having me, 100%.
Of course. It was really good to meet you, too. But for listeners, please, right now, please go follow Pat Van Dyke on Spotify. But honestly, you should just go to his pvdmusic.bandcamp.com. You know, buy a record. You could literally buy a vinyl of Pat's music, and it will sound fantastic. I promise you, they're really great listens. Follow him on Instagram, PVD Music on Instagram. And yeah, check out his website too. You know, hey, hit him up if you want to have him maybe record something for you, whatever it might be. Hit him up. Pat, pleasure to talk to you, man. Thank you so
pleasure,
much.
Pleasure to be here, Anthony. I appreciate you reaching out and making this happen. And, you know, I look forward to hearing the final product. So
looking
thanks
forward
again, man.
Looking forward to mixing. Yep. All right, listeners, take care. Thanks, Pat.
Thank you.